accession number 28355, reel 12.
I'm sorry, getting the personal chemistry.
Getting the personal chemistry is very helpful. So,
And was an army, because Peter Le Villiers was 3-star, was an army lieutenant general sent in the end because the land force element got quite big? In fact, got very big.
Why did we send a 3-star officer? Because
and an army 3-star. That was because... To replace Paddy Hine, that was the...
No. Paddy Hine was the 4-star officer back in UK.
Of course, I apologise. I mean,
Sandy Wilson was at 2-star level, but by the time we got round to putting Peter Le Billy out there, of course, we'd increased our forces,
yes,
both on the ground and in the air, particularly on the ground, in a very large measure. And
yes.
So it was right that it should be a 3-star, and that made it probably a little easier to get alongside the Americans, both because of the size of the force we were deploying and because Peter was himself a 3-star officer.
Yes.
So, I had a discussion that afternoon with Tom King. Remember I mentioned the Americans' concern about hostages. Clearly, I was worried, and I'm sure he was too, you know, what action the United States might take. It died away eventually. I can't remember exactly what. But and also I talked to about, you know, what we were going to be likely to do if we wanted to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait. So that we had a fairly sort of general conversation about that, which, as it says here, gave him a lot to think about. And I also spoke to Hine and passed on some of Tom King's minor points. A good one, like a civil advisor for Wilson, which was getting was a good one, and a not so bright one, like giving him a Hercules. You know, this we're not exactly rich in Hercules. I never can be rich in anything like that.
This presumably was to enable him to fly around his
command,
which was quite large, really, I suppose.
Well, yes, but he didn't need a hack to do it, you know. I think we did give him a 125 at once. So we certainly gave Peter Le Villiers a 125. I can't remember whether... I don't think we had it out there in Wilson's time. The weekend of... First, second, I was in Norfolk in lovely weather, it says here, about the 3rd of September... I don't know what that's about.
Do you want me to pause for a minute?
No, I think then I went to see Tom King was in the usual paper flap. We had the war cabinet at 9:45, which agreed no need for Scorpions in Bahrain. PM was anxious to know from me if we were ready for a surprise attack. Too many aircraft all lined up, she thought. In fact, I think we had already started to take care of that. And the same day, Winston Chu, who was my opted number in the Singapore Armed Forces, and the UK mil rep, who was DSAC, calls a variety of non-Gulf issues. Also, CS India and His Majesty's Ambassador Bogota. And found myself dealing with a few other things apart from the Gulf. And the key issue there was still to resolve the command and control. The staff solution backing into the joint commander back at High Wycombe and the commander in the theatre. And I says, I've already been saying, I said, I must have the ability to switch on and off the UK contribution. For one man in theatre in the area, it was essential. In fact, just before I went off my Concorde flight, Tom King was playing cricket in that there was a cricket pitch outside or up across the road from the Royal Hospital, Chelsea. So on my way out to my Concorde flight, I dropped in to see Tom King and his whites. He was still sort of fussing about UK National Command. I explained that, you know, if he's talking about, he means overriding authority and to tell Parliament that, yes. And he wanted me to sound out Colin Powell. Colin Powell was going to see what more would the US like. I think we have had a good feel for this beginning to come up. But if we're in for a long haul, I said, we don't want to get overcommitted.
You were starting to get a feel for it, of course, through your Schwarzkopf.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And I went on to Concorde and crossed the Atlantic, back to 53,000 feet. 1,700 miles to go at 1,280 miles an hour.
They didn't let you fly it, though?
No. Food so-so, chip plate and not rosette. Good wine saved grace. Very cramped, so moved to the back. It was only about 60% full where I could spread myself and do some work. Very casual, very difficult to read classified material, so or write it for that matter. I moved myself down to the back.
Who did you take with you?
I just had my PSO with me. Nobody else. No, not on that trip. I didn't even have him. I just went on my own. Arrived in Washington. Wainwright Hall was the VIP accommodation for German Joint Chiefs of Staff guests. And I think the ambassador was away, but the minister and the head of BDSW came and talked to me, and then I gave Colin Powell a ring, or in fact he rang me, and he asked me over for a nightcap. His quarter was just across the road from Wainwright Hall, so I just walked across, and we had a very friendly nightcap together, and a good general discussion, and a chance to register some of the points which were treat more formally at the breakfast meeting. So, you know, right from the start, was sort of open door, easy relationship, which was very helpful. The next day, 4th September, I went to Pentagon for breakfast. I had an intelligence brief. It says here, a bit long-winded. I stressed the need for good command and control and the need for a UK withhold. Which Colin fully accepted. The most wanted were ground forces armour, which we knew already, but you know, it was right from the horse's mouth. That's what they wanted. And then back by Concorde, writing my report in Concorde after debriefing the embassy personnel. Next day, 5th of September, I reported my visit to the United States to the War Cabinet. Secretary of State clearly not keen to be bounced into more commitments, which we were considering. Wilson rang with good news because he was being cut in by the United States Air Force into their full operational plan. So we'd achieved what I hoped we'd achieve there, I think, having spent spoken to Colin Powell about it too. It had sort of made sure that it would happen. We had a long Chiefs of Staff meeting on the 6th of September. Got the shopping list I'd asked for of further military options. And command and control, I insisted we took a thing which was called Option 4, which was the joint command of the Command of British Forces, with the latter having operational command over the RN assets. And there was a rearguard naval attempt to keep their own command system and to draw up and to drum up United States naval support for this. Normally, ships worldwide in peacetime are controlled from Sixth Fleet's headquarters. It's a well-understood arrangement. But I was, because they were going to be working with the United States Navy, I want to be quite certain that I had the what I called Option 4, which was CDS having overall. And eventually, you know, we got there. But it was interesting. I mean, I wasn't unsympathetic to the Navy's position because it was familiar and they had all the communications. I think they were concerned, would Command of British Forces have access to the right communications to speak to a ship in the Gulf or wherever. You know? And I said, well, if he hasn't now, I'm sure you can make sure that he has. That mustn't be the stumbling block. But, that, you know, that was the sort of, as far as I was concerned, and I'm sure, you know, any CDS before or after would take the same line, he must be in a position to call the thing to stop it, or to get it started for that matter. On the say-so of the Prime Minister or Secretary of State. The next day, that was the 6th. The 7th of September, I was playing golf with the CDS from Singapore and the Singapore High Commission and dinner. I'd obviously minute the Secretary of State about the military options, and he wanted an artillery brigade considered. I had a chat with John Chappell of the CDS about this, and we'll talk again about it on the 10th of September, which was the Monday. So over the weekend we were sort of thinking about it. After further talks with John Chappell, I went to see Secretary of State on the 10th of September, and we discussed the military options and talked him around to the Armoured Brigade, which Chappell and I had agreed was the best military option. It meets the need, its operation is strong, it's repeatable, it's sustainable. It's what the Americans were looking for. And I had a further long chat in the middle of all this with Sandy Wilson out in theatre, now linked in with the American Air Force planning. And he wanted to commit some RAF aircraft to these contingency plans. And so I agreed that he could plan on 24 Tornadoes, GR1s. I authorised them to, subject obviously to government approval, if and when we ever came to using them. But at least this would give the Americans a feeling that we were going to participate. We then had a further discussion with the Secretary of State, CGS, ACGS. Archie Hamilton was MinAF, I was trying to think, and Archie over a sandwich lunch. There's always a fly paper, disjointed discussion, it says here. And we'll put a paper of the Prime Minister on the military options. This is the land forces. Um, CIS and I agreed we should leave the Jaguars still in Oman rather than bringing them forward. So my recommendation to the Prime Minister and Secretary of State was an armoured brigade, a dozen, well, 8 GR1s and 4 GR1As, 6 F3s, postpone any decision about the carrier, leaving the Jaguars where they were. I then went to the dentist to lance an abscess.
Can I just ask, the armoured brigade, one got the impression...
This was a 7 armoured brigade.
Yes, that it was a very big armoured brigade. Was it a conventional armoured brigade, or was it really... called an armoured brigade, but... Really,
well, we'll get to the numbers.
Okay.
I always... You know, do you measure it by name or do you measure it by numbers? And
yes.
I think you tend to measure it by numbers because you better feel for
right.
how big or not it is.
Right.
And I think it was also at this time that, because I was, the original plan, you may remember, was before all this started, that Dick Finson would replace me in about February. But it was agreed that I would stay to the end of March, not thinking we were going to get into a war or anything. Really, to give a Dick Vincent, who was looking on long-term costings and sort of what you might call in-house MOD stuff, give him a break for when he finished the LTC round, which would be sort of January time, before he came and took over from me. So he got a probably, I think LTC was probably into February, so he got a break through March, and I would hand over in April. Then we had another, on the next day, the 11th, we had an interesting war cabinet meeting, which started with the Prime Minister again sending challengers, and having begun to persuade Tom King that the armoured brigade was the right thing and not any other options, the right military solution to meet the United States requirement and is politically significant, spent the rest of the day battling with the doubters about the use of Challenger and sending an armoured brigade. MinAF, Archie Hamilton, it just won't work. CDP, Peter Levine, very against. What does he know of day-to-day availability in regiments? VCDS, Vickers Defence Services, Colin Chandler, who was then in charge, who was anti, and half an hour later he was for. And Jerry Boxall, who I think must have been the chief executive, I think, in Vickers Defence, Vickers were the manufacturers of Challenger. We went into every widget and filter with Tom King. It really was a terrible way to do business. What a way to do business, I say here. But I got good support from ACGS, but at the end of the day, VCDS said he had grave doubts. Now, VCDS, of course, is a gunner. MGO hadn't given proper advice. There had been all sorts of trials out in the desert, which hadn't gone very well. VCDS said the desert trials were disasters, and nobody reads the reviews. He was trying to protect me, he said. And as I say here, a horrible feeling of inter-arms tribalism. Army would want to get in on the act and deploy argument accordingly, says VCDS. In other words, VCDS saying the Army are keen to get in the act, pressing for the Army Brigade, but he, VCDS, you know, trying to protect me. The final challenge of blow apparently was unstable explosive, and the Army certainly didn't cover themselves in glory, but I'm sure we've got to go for the Armoured Brigade and make it work.
Can you explain the unstable explosive point?
No. There was something to do with the rounds in with which Challenger was fitted. Whether it was heat or what, I can't remember. No, you'd have to go to somebody else to be able to. There was a problem. So this is all I can tell you from this now, this 15 years on. One was faced with this problem. We wanted to send an armoured brigade. We had to send Challengers. As we find out later, we had to rob the whole Challenger fleet of engines to get the armoured brigades running. And it really stretched the army in Germany very much. But we got them there, and they did very well. But it was against a background of an awful lot of doubt. On the one hand, you want the Americans want it, militarily it was the right thing to do, and then you have the politicians fussing, if it all goes pear-shaped, there's egg on their face. You have the tribalism. You have the manufacturers, and Peter Levine, blowing hot and cold. And the army itself not putting their case together perhaps as robustly as they could have done, and certainly not exposing some of the arguments. Probably if they'd exposed the explosive argument early on, we might have never got as far as we did get. Anyway, but as I say, we have got to go for an armoured brigade and make it work. And then I spoke, I think, two or three times the next day to Sandy Wilson out in the Gulf. Mainly my own and, I think, at Tom King's behest, to get Schwarzkopf's reactions to ground force options. Apparently there was press speculation about what we were going to send, and Tom King was thoroughly irritated about that. Said it must be due to the army. See, at this time, the army are on the hind leg. We've got the Air Force got out there, the Navy are in theater and looking around, and the army aren't in the scene. It's special forces and odds and ends, but they went there in operational mode. And Tom King, I think, was clearly irritated. He thought the army were sort of leaking to the media that we were going to send things before he, Tom King, had sort of said we would or hadn't necessarily told Parliament about it. Tom King was irritated by press speculation said to be due to the army. CGS reassured Tom King that it wasn't. And I said, here, I think it was Clark. I think it was pretty likely.
You have just touched on special forces there. Mm. What was the degree of special forces commitment and deployment at this stage?
I can't remember the details, I'm afraid. I'm sure we had started down that track because, they would have wanted to do some recce and so on. But exactly when that started, it wasn't something that was crossing my desk or needed to cross my desk. We weren't into committing them into Iraq or into Kuwait or anything like that at that stage. But they SAS should have been thinking. I'm sure they were thinking about if they had to go and do some hostage rescue or anything like that. They should have been getting their thoughts together on that sort of thing. But I don't know from this, and I certainly can't remember now what in detail they were up to.
But at this stage, mid-September, second week, they're not involved on the ground inside Iraq or Kuwait?
No, to your knowledge? No, certainly not.
Okay.
This time, on the 12th of September, I was also still having further problems with the Navy about the giving OPCON to the Joint Force Commander. And then I was told the Prime Minister now wants a briefing on Challenger. And apparently the Prime Minister, Archie Hamilton, and Dick Vincent had had a discussion late that night on the 12th, which Tom King wasn't privy to, and nor was I. So, but it obviously sparked the Prime Minister into wanting to have this brief on the Challenger. So we went to the Prime Minister after lunch on the 13th, re-Challenger's reliability, and she launched off into Nimrod, and how that had been an absolute disaster, and I'd been involved with Nimrod. I had to point out to her that I'd flown Nimrod and had told her that it was useless. We got all this thrown at us. And eventually she wanted us all to sign a paper saying we supported sending Challenger. She is, as always, you know, very anxious to probe, although Tom King did handle her quite well on these occasions.
Was the Prime Minister completely on top of her game? I know she made mistakes about Hawke and things like
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes.
No, she was formidable in that sense. She was. I mean, she knew her own mind. I mean, you always had to stand up to her. It was no good agreeing with her if you had the slightest doubt. You'd really well have to launch into her. And I found at times, not necessarily in this particular time, but if you put your case strongly enough, and you all then went away to reconsider, she would be presenting your case. She had this habit of starting the meeting with, this is my position. Push me off it if you, bump me off it if you dare, or if you can. But, you know, and if there wasn't an attempt made to bump her off, then I don't think she was necessarily as firmly wedded to what she proposed. And she was then rather more fussed about it. And she'd had a really good stout argument about it and satisfied herself that her original position was right, or if she felt that maybe it wasn't, then you would come back the next time and she'd start from the new position. It was an interesting technique. It's not one I myself have ever employed. And I've not met many that do. But it was her technique, and I mean, I think she's admitted many times she likes an argument. She certainly liked an argument, and but she was, you know, she'd been through the Falklands, and she'd obviously got very blooded on that, and learnt, you know, the hard way how it all happens, and so she was bringing that knowledge in general terms very much into play, and how she was handling this one, except that she felt she did know it all, and at times she had to be persuaded that Hawks wasn't a good idea, for example. we all signed this bit of paper.
Can you explain that, please? You signed a bit of paper.
This was a bit of paper she wanted us all to sign, saying that we, I, CDS, I, Tom King, I, whoever else was around the table, believe it's right to send Challengers to Saudi Arabia. I don't know what she was going to do with it if it, Challengers had broken down. I suppose she waved it in front of us, but I didn't actually see the great point in it. But nevertheless, she wanted us to sign it, so sign it we did. maybe for the record. Also about this time, we had I had Wilson on the phone saying that Prince Khalid who was the Saudi Arabian chief of defence, one of the many members of the family, was wanting to command the UK ground forces.
Another sensible suggestion.
Yes. We obviously succeeded in correcting that, but I can't remember exactly whether we come to it or not. But anyway, we did. We had a meeting then on the 14th of September, both the War Cabinet and then the full Cabinet OD, which of course includes the Chancellor, and all were supportive apart from the Chancellor, and I had to speak firmly in riposte, it says here. The signed minute, which I talked about a moment ago, was seen as very significant in winning over the doubters, so it did have its value as far as her colleagues were concerned. And the PM said, you know, you could add helicopters and all the support we needed. And we said 80% battlefield availability of the Challengers.